Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Brian O'Neill, a writer and editor for hire, as well as a Catholic journalist whose work is featured in publications such as the National Catholic Register and Catholic World Report. And he can be heard as a regular guest on EWTN's The Sunrise Morning Show with Brian Patrick. However, he is perhaps best known as the author of several books, including 39 Saints You Should Know, Saint Who? 39 Holy Unknowns, and the newly released 150 North American Martyrs You Should Know. We previously featured an interview with Brian about the 39 Holy Unknowns, which we'll link back to, as well as links to his other books, so please check out our website. And I should mention that he is not only a prodigious author in the literary sense, but he is also a loving husband and father of six children, all being raised as fans of the Green Bay Packers. Brian, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's good to be back. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I have to apologize for my voice here. I got a little bit of bronchitis and coughing a little bit, so we'll just bear with me through this interview. I should also note that we are recording this on January 2nd, and we're releasing it later in the month, January 19th, I believe. And I am hoping that we will be celebrating a Green Bay Packer defeat of the San Francisco 49ers. What's your prognostication there?
The thing is, the weather forecast is supposed to be a high of anywhere between 4 and 9 degrees, doesn't count the wind chill, with a low of 15 to 16 degrees. And given the fact that they're going to be playing at a time when it's still not very long days, and in the late afternoon, it's going to be closer to those lows, I hope the 49ers bring their thermal underoos because they're going to need them.
All right. Well, we'll see how that goes.
Indeed.
And it's cold. It's January now, and we just finished up with December, which I think everybody knows. It's December's all about Christmas and jolly St. Nicholas. In a few weeks, we're going to be moving into February, and everybody knows that means St. Valentine's Day. And then we're on to March with my Irish buddy, St. Patrick. And then it's the Easter season, and you know what? It just seems like January is a month that is really bereft of holidays for well-known religious figures. So what's the problem with January?
That's a great question, Tony. The good news is that there are plenty of saints for January. Indeed, there is a saint for every day of the year. But this month we have St. Polycarp, who was a disciple of St. John the Evangelist. I mean, how great would that be, right? You don't get to know Jesus, but you get to know someone who knew Jesus. We have the feasts of Saints Timothy and Titus, conversion of St. Paul, St. Francis de Sales, St. John Bosco, the church doctor St. John Chrysostom, St. Thomas Aquinas, who's another church doctor, and a bunch of others. So lots of great saints for the month of January.
That's interesting. I didn't know January was the month for St. Thomas Aquinas. I mean, he's a big name, right? Everybody in college,
yeah.
Especially if you go to Marquette or Notre Dame, you got to read Aquinas. And you don't hear about that too much. We don't get an official day off, or we don't have any Hallmark greeting cards for Aquinas Day.
No, you don't. It's even hard to find statues of the man. So, it's just... one of the greatest saints ever in the history of the church.
Definitely.
The teaching is based off of his writings.
No, absolutely. And that's kind of interesting. You mentioned that there is a saint for every day of the year. I also happen to know that there are more saints than there are days of the year. So there must be some doubling up on some of these days, right?
That's exactly right. So, for instance, on some days you'll have as many as 15 or 20 days. Sundays you'll have as many as 15 or 20 saints whose feast is on that day. Very, very rare that you would have one. Let's take Christmas. Okay, so we just celebrated Christmas last month. It is not only the feast of the Nativity of our Lord, it's also the feast of Saint Anastasia. St. Anastasia, because before they set Christmas as December 25th, remember in the early centuries of the church it wasn't celebrated, and then when it was, there was some disagreement as to when it was. So you have St. Anastasia, her feast day was almost from the get-go celebrated on that day.
Wow. Well, I did not know that. That's kind of fascinating. How do they end up picking the days that these saints will be celebrated? Is it the day of their birth, the day of their death, the day they perform some miracle? Is there any kind of formula for this?
There is. It's kind of, you might say it's both their birth and their death. It's their dies natalis, the day of their birth into eternal life. So typically it is the day on which they died. However, if... for instance, I think St. Thérèse of Lisieux, her feast day is in October, but I don't think it's on the day in which she died. I think they moved it to another day so as to not confuse it with another saint who was pretty prominent and, you know, had the same date. Or they might do it, they might have that, their feast of the translation of their relics. That is to say, their relics were in place A and then they were taken to place B. There are, occasional times where it's a date different than they died. Almost exclusively, however, it is on the date they died.
Well, at least there's some flexibility in the system there. And I can imagine that different places around the world or different local cultures celebrate different feast days, probably because, you know, there's some local connection to it, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, well, one of the saints... for this month, his name is St. John Newman, and while his feast is celebrated on the 5th of this month here in the U.S., in his home country of the Czech Republic, it is March 5th.
Hmm.
So you do have, or you might have the person's religious order, say a person was a Dominican, so they may celebrate their feast or their memorial, maybe more appropriately put, on, September 29th, but the rest of the church celebrates their feast on World Memorial on October the 27th.
Wow. You really got to have a scorecard for all of this. I mean, some calendar.
Yeah.
I mean, you're the expert on saints, and I love coming back to you and reading your stuff because you tell such great stories of this. But, I mean, even with all your knowledge, you must have some calendar up there that says, okay, these are the 15 saints this today.
I cannot keep them straight. In fact, I do. I have a little working document. I shared a bit of it with you, actually, in our email discussion leading up to this conversation. And that, I just basically cut and paste from that document because otherwise, how am I supposed to remember there are 10,000 blesseds and saints in the canon of the church? And so, there's just no way of a normal person who's not autistic or some sort of savant could remember that sort of thing.
I know. Somebody has to write a phone app for that. I'm sure there probably is.
That probably is, yeah.
Yeah. You just mentioned something interesting. You said saints and blesseds, and I know we covered this in our previous interview, and we're going to be talking about saints and blesseds. I'm probably going to get the two terms confused quite a bit, but there is some difference between these two titles, and so what is the difference between a blessed and a saint, and how does one come to those ranks?
Well, the basic progression is that, someone puts forward your cause, a diocese, a religious order, even just an interested group. For instance, there's a group of Argentinian laymen who are trying to get G.K. Chesterton beatified. But Chesterton is his works have been translated into Spanish, and so he is well-beloved. In fact, the Pope is a big fan of Chesterton. And so, they have this interest. So they're trying to promote his canonization or beatification cause, rather. But once you get the go-ahead from the local bishop to say yes, this is going forward, then what happens is that person is called a servant of God or the servant of God. So it would be the servant of God, Father John Hardin, the servant of God, whoever. And then they become, the Vatican, first the diocese investigates the cause, and then after that, all the paperwork is sent in these big, huge, formal boxes, in these beautiful, big, leather-bound books to something called the Congregation for the Causes of Saints. It's basically the Department of Saints, if you will, if we're going to use our government as an example. You know, there's Department of Defense, Department of State. Well, the Vatican has something like a Department of Saints, the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, and it's sent there. They do an investigation, and at the end of it, if they think that this person exhibited quote-unquote heroic virtue, they ask the Holy Father to present a decree or to sign a decree of holy of witness to this fact, and then if he agrees with that, with their recommendation, they become, that person becomes venerable. So like, for instance, it was the Venerable Father Solanus Casey, and now it's just Venerable Solanus Casey, you know, the priest from Detroit. And then after that, if they get him, and even during the Servant of God phase, it can happen sometimes, but if they get a miracle attributed to them, and a miracle is something that cannot be proved through medical science, what have you, alone. There's no earthly explanation for why, for instance, I think it was in Ecuador, a boy actually regrew a limb, which sounds fantastic and is like, okay, yeah, you gullible Catholics, but there are news reports to this effect, and I'm probably getting the country wrong. It was somewhere in South or Lower Central America, though, that this did happen. With the case of Blessed John Paul II, the miracle that put him into the category of beatified is the French nun who also, like he had, suffered from Parkinson's disease, was cured of it, and so on and so forth. Doctors couldn't explain this, so doctors on the local level couldn't explain it, and doctors at the Vatican couldn't explain it, and so they, you know, it's a very rigorous process. You know, the last thing the Vatican wants to do is come forward with a declaration that someone's a saint because of a miracle and have some scientists or doctors say, oh, that's easily explainable, this is how it happened. So it's very, very rigorous. They won't say that it is a miracle unless it truly is a miracle. And then, so you have to have one to become beatified, to be declared a blessed, and then you have to have another one to be declared a saint. And they can't, it's not like if you get two during your blood beatification phase, you know, you can't use one for the beatification phase and one for the canonization phase. It has to be a miracle that happened after you were declared blessed or beatified. And the difference between, there's a very slight difference between blessed and canonized. And in fact, I'm putting together an op-ed for hopefully for publication later this year that's going to argue that we do away with the differentiation, because it used to be, well, beatification, when someone's declared blessed, it means they're a saint. They're in heaven. They're enjoying the beatific vision of God, okay? It's not like they're becoming a saint makes them more of a saint. It's just that their veneration, that is to say, you know, the devotion to them is really limited to a local place. So, for instance, the Feast of Blessed John Paul II is limited to the diocese, and the dioceses of Poland. So, you know, Poland has 14 archdioceses, and I don't know however many dioceses spread out amongst those 14, but, you know, so all the dioceses in Poland, they can celebrate the Feast of John Paul II. All the dioceses of Rome can, and like just one or two or three places else in the world have some claim to him, so they get to celebrate it as well. But the rest of the church does not have a universal feast of John Paul II. Now, when he becomes St. John Paul II this April, when Pope Francis canonizes him, along with Blessed John the 23rd, he will be St. John Paul II, and he will be on the universal calendar of saints. So it's a it's just a matter of local versus universal veneration.
Okay, that's.
But in this age, you know, when you have, you know, Blessed Gianamola was a saint superstar before she was ever even thought of being canonized. Same with Padre Pio and any number of other people that we can probably think of in recent memory. Saint Jose Maria Escrivá. I mean, given the fact that the blessed part proves that they're in heaven, do we really need to go on with the next step of canonization?
Yeah, it's just kind of like getting an extra ribbon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, in this game, if you will, it really, it's it's become, I think, kind of meaningless.
Well, we'll see what becomes of your op-ed piece. Maybe you'll be there changing Vatican history or something. I don't know. And that was one of my next questions I was going to ask, too, is how John Paul II is doing. But apparently the canonization is set for April.
It is, yeah.
Okay.
And Divine Mercy Sunday, or as we used to call it, Low Sunday.
Okay. Now, did he get fast-tracked because he was a pope? Or
No, it wasn't because he was a pope. It was because of the outpouring. If you remember his funeral, there were all these banners that said Santo Subito, Saint Now. In other words, declare him a saint right this very moment. And so, you know, he was, that's what prompted Benedict XVI to say, okay, go ahead and fast track this, because you're supposed to wait 5 years from the time a person's dead. From the day they died, it has to be 5 years before a cause can be opened. And John Paul II fast-tracked Mother Teresa, and Benedict fast-tracked John Paul II.
Okay. Well, that's pretty interesting to know. Let's talk about some January saints, though. Because as you mentioned, there's January. I thought there was no saints in January because we don't have Hallmark cards for them. But there are plenty of them. And as I understand it, you happen to have a personal favorite, Blessed Maria Teresa. I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but I'm going to give it a try. Fasce? Maria Fasce. Teresa Fasce. Okay.
Yeah, Fasce. She's, it's her, I mean, it was a tie, it's a toss-up between her and Blessed Mama Rosa. I mean, how can you not love someone who goes by Blessed Mama Rosa?
It sounds like a pizza place.
I know.
And I love pizza. Yeah.
It's just absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's just, she's a great old gal. But Blessed Maria Teresa Fasce is an Italian saint, and her feast is January 18th. So probably, you know, a couple of days after this, before this airs. And when she was 19, Leo XIII canonized St. Rita of Kasha, who had been an Augustinian nun in the town of Kasha. Imagine that. Anyway, Rita's order began making her known, presenting her as an example for the whole world. And her story, Rita's story, really piqued Maria's interest, who was absolutely fascinated by her. And she had already she was a noble, of noble birth, and she had already contemplated a religious vocation, but now she decided she wanted to be an Augustinian nun, just like St. Rita, and she wanted to do so in Kasha. But both her family and the Kasha Augustinians rejected the idea.
Hmm. Why did they reject the idea?
The family, because she was a noblewoman, and they wanted her to get married and produce grandchildren and all that fun sort of thing. You know, not that we have that issue today with people discouraging vocations for want of grandchildren. And the they were from Genoa, which is in northern Italy on the coast, on the western coast, not too far from France. And Kasha is about an hour and a half, 2.5 hours drive from Rome. It's pretty well removed, and it would be probably like going from Seattle down to Eureka, California, or maybe even San Francisco. I mean, it's a bit of a drive.
Yeah.
The family wouldn't even get to see her that much. The Augustinians didn't think so because, she wasn't a local, but also because she was a noblewoman, and how would she handle the austerities of convent life, by goodness? So they both rejected the idea, but Maria was really persistent, and she eventually persuaded both parties to let her come in. And when she came in, there was a bunch of infighting, and she got so discouraged by it, she actually quit for about a year. She went home, and then she asked if she could come back. She reconsidered, and they let her in. And after taking her final vows in 1912, she became abbess just 8 years later, and she held that position. I mean, that's pretty remarkable, because she's in her early 20s when she takes her final vows, and so just 8 years later, so maybe early 30s, she becomes abbess and holds that position for the rest of her life.
Wait a minute. What is that position? Is that the head of the...
Yeah, it's just so, like, you know, just as an abbot would be the head of a religious monastery or, a convent for men. So she was the head of the convent, the religious superior for these women. And basically an abbess is kind of like a bishop. It's the only It's kind of like a bishop. It's the only female religious office, if you will, where the people, where the person can bless someone. So, like you and I, when you and I go for communion mass, and we're holding our children or something, and the female Eucharist, extraordinary Eucharistic minister blesses our child because they can't receive yet, that's illicit. They can't do that. They have no powers to bless. The only people that we have a power to bless are those, are our own very own biological children, because we are head of the domestic church, and so we can do that, or mothers and fathers can. Women, other than that, cannot licitly bless, in a strict sense, you know, anything. But abbesses can. So if you're in front of an abbess, you can kneel before her and ask for her blessing, and she can give it to you, and it's just like a priest giving you his blessing. So, she, you know, it's a pretty important position. Anyway, totally off topic. But, you know, one of the things that made her successful as an abbess was her realization that the thing that had caused this rift I mentioned when she came into the convent was the nuns taking their eyes off of their true reason for being there, and that was to serve Jesus Christ. And so she insisted on this regimen of prayer, scripture, meditation, and the sacraments. And that was her constant focus as abbess. And she also told her sister that Jesus didn't want his brides to be dolls, but to be, you know, to just kind of sit there motionless, in other words, but to labor and to be really active. And because of she, you know, again, she had this big love for St. Rita, and so here she is in the home of St. Rita, and because of her love for this saint, she desired to make her known and to bring people closer to Christ through St. Rita's example. So she started this magazine dedicated to her, and it's still in print today. I got a copy when I was in Kasha, and it's pretty well done. And the donations for, you know, the subscriptions to it paid for this new pilgrim shrine. And by her efforts, the nuns built both a new church to house St. Rita's incorrupt body, but also a girls' orphanage, which they called the Beehive. And now, Blessed Mother Maria Teresa Fasce had lost her mother when she was a very young girl. And so she was now going to be a mother to these girls who also had no mother. And she was always playing with the girls and loving them, who she called her bees. And it said that she became a child when she was in their midst. In fact, there's a statue outside the convent that shows her playing with the children, even though she's quite rotund. And for 30 years, she suffered from a malignant breast tumor on her right breast. And though it was terribly painful, she had to endure two operations, she never complained, which is remarkable. I mean, my mother-in-law went through it, God rest her soul, and it's just a terrible disease. And to not complain is really amazing. But she called the cancer her treasure, Tony, because it allowed her to suffer like her bridegroom, Christ. I guess it's all in your attitude, huh? But she also had heart disease, asthma, diabetes, and circulatory problems that made her feet hurt. And because she couldn't exercise, she became really obese. And her poor sisters, because when it became too difficult for her to walk, that meant that they had to carry her whenever she needed to get about. Ultimately, the breast cancer prevailed, and on the morning of January 18, 1947, she passed away. And her incorrupt body is in the crypt next to the basilica she built for St. Rita, which thousands of pilgrims each year now visit because of her efforts. And that's how I came to find about her. I had gone downstairs to see the tomb of Blessed Simon Fidati, who was St. Rita's spiritual director, as well as a Eucharistic miracle they have in the crypt. And on the other side of it, there's this incorrupt body of this big, rotund woman. And who the heck is this? And picked up the prayer cards and fell in love with her almost immediately.
Yeah. Very cool story. Let's turn to another one. And it's one that you mentioned at the outset of our interview, a guy named John Newman.
Yeah.
And he is pretty famous here in the United States. At least I have heard of him. So he must be pretty famous because I'm not up on my Catholic saints. He must have been a saint for putting up a whole mess of Catholic centers around college campuses around the country, because that's what I know him for, the Newman centers that you see encircling various universities here in the U.S. What is his story all about?
Well, actually, he's known better more for parochial schools as opposed to centers on colleges, because those are actually named after Blessed John Henry Cardinal Newman.
Oh, well, see, I got that completely wrong. Here I thought I was up on top of things, but I'm not.
Well, and it's fine. I didn't even think about it until you were talking. But it was. But that's. But it's a reasonable mistake to make, because their names are pronounced the same. It's not Neumann like I used to think. It's Newman. And so when you hear the two, you just, and given the fact that they're a United States phenomenon, you would naturally make that connection.
Yeah, there can't be that many U.S. Catholics named Newman.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Especially those who are saints, and you would figure that sort of thing would be named after a saint. But
yeah.
Newman was a big learner and scholar, and so, and St. John was very smart, but he wasn't on the same level. But St. John's feast day is January 5th, and he was the fourth bishop of Philadelphia. Now, he wasn't from the U.S. Instead, he was from Bohemia, which is now in the Czech Republic. It's a region of the Czech Republic, and he came to America to become a missionary priest. They had a priest glut in Bohemia, and so his local bishop said, thanks, but no, it's not that you don't have a vocation, it's just we don't have any room for you. There's too many priests here already. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
It's amazing. Anyway, he was ordained here after his studies, and at first he was sent to minister to German immigrants in New York State. But in 1840s, he joined the Redemptorist Order, and they sent him to Pittsburgh, and it's famous St. Philomena Church. If you ever get a chance to be in Pittsburgh, make sure you make a pilgrimage to that church. It's fantastic and has a lot of history, but he was there. And he was also kind of that was the hub of his spoke of his wheel, if you will, because he was sent out to all of these churches in the surrounding area, which is why if you ever go to Steubenville, Ohio, and attend one of their conferences or something, and happen to go to Mass at St. Peter's downtown, it's a gorgeous church, you ought to, you'll see his face on the large mural there, because he was that parish's priest. And so anyway, in 1852, he became Bishop of Philadelphia and the first bishop in the U.S. to organize a school system. You see, the anti-Catholic nativists in Philadelphia, the Know Nothing Party and those types, were always getting Protestant dogma slipped into the public schools curriculum, with the result that many students either left the faith or were really confused. And the parents were all up in arms about it, but, you know, they didn't really know what to do. In the face of this, they had to send their kids to school. They wanted to get them an education, help them become Americans. But by the same token, what were they supposed to do in the face of all this anti-Catholic harassment? So he established the parochial school system as we know it. And by the time he died, Philadelphia had 200 parochial schools. It had one when he took office. It had 200 by the time he died.
What time span was that? How long did that occur? I mean, he becomes Bishop of Philadelphia, and then he dies. Was it 15, 20, 30 years?
He died 8 years later.
8 years and that had that many schools?
Yeah, and get this.
Wow.
One source says that he established and built so many new parish churches within the diocese that they were completed at almost the rate of one a month.
Wow, that's cooking.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was not one to rest on his laurels. And he was also really, really frugal. He kept in war the entire time he was in the United States. So he gets here in sometime before 1840, and he dies in 1860. So in that 20-plus year span, he had one pair of boots. And whenever someone gave him a new set of vestments, a new cassock or something like this, he would often use them to fit the newest ordained priest in the diocese. So he would never keep anything for himself. He was just walking about, and he collapsed one day in 1860 at age 48, and he died. And he was canonized by Paul VI in 1977. Now, he's the first, and really, as far as I know, as far as I can recall at this very moment, only male American saint. We have two female American saints who were born in this country. The rest of them were born elsewhere and came here. We have no American saints that are male, native-born American saints that are male.
Yeah, so he's the closest because he immigrated over.
Yeah, and if you're familiar with the Batman movies, at least the ones starring Christian Bale, and you know the Crane, Dr. Crane or Scarecrow character, is played by an actor named Cillian Murphy. And if you ever go to Bishop Newman's Shrine in downtown Philadelphia, you would swear that you're looking at a wax, Madame Tussaud's wax effigy of Cillian Murphy at sleep. I mean, the two must have looked amazingly alike.
Well, they should make a movie of John Newman and star this guy. Yeah, while he's still in his 40s or something, and so he can. So what miracles did he get credited with? I mean, it seems that building a new parish every month back in the middle part of the 1800s, that's got to be a miracle.
Far as I know, I really don't know, to be honest with you. That's the one thing, because I know that I get lost in the details as it is, that if I was to try to remember exactly, what got him canonized, I would probably melt my brain. But and back then, you had to have two miracles to be beatified and two miracles to be canonized. John Paul II changed that shortly after he became pope to just one each. So there would have been four miracles to account for in his case.
Well, the building things that fast and creating a school system in a mere 8 years is pretty miraculous. So I could see.
No doubt. Yeah.
Let's go to another part of the world. And you sent me a list of these January saints, and one of these caught my eye because it was in your previous book, Saint Who, 39 Holy Unknowns. And it's from somebody out in Nigeria, Blessed Cyprian Michael, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, I'm going to try it, Iwane Tansi. So let me try
it. Pretty close. Iwane Tansi, yeah. He's a great saint, Tony. I love this guy. I love him because he's tough. You know, he was kind of, he wasn't Father Feel Good. He wasn't Father Let's Be Jolly. But he was just a no-nonsense, bread-and-butter, here's what we have to do to be holy, so let's do it, sort of guy. And what happened was he was a convert from paganism, who learned the faith at the parochial school to which his parents had sent him. And when he received, a few years later, when he received holy orders in 1937, he was one of only 10 native priests in all of Nigeria. And for the next 13 years, he rode his bicycle around his very, very large, territorially large parish to serve the faithful. And one of his special focuses was working with youth. And, Tony, this is how on All Saints Day in 1941 that he came to baptize a little 9-year-old local boy who idolized him, absolutely worshipped the ground this guy walked on and wanted to be just like him. And today, we call that youngster Francis Cardinal Arinze. And for many years, people thought he would be the first African pope in a millennium.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it just shows how what one priest who's holy and takes his vocation seriously, what they can do. And he was also really good. Father Tansi was also really good at marriage preparation. If a couple wanted him to marry them, he would not let them live together beforehand. I've spoken with some priests today who tell me, gosh, if I tried doing that, I wouldn't marry any of my couples. Because almost all of them that present themselves to him are living together out of wedlock. But if the couples protested that they needed to save money and were too poor to live apart, he found the woman, the fiancé, some shelter, some place to live. And indeed, the value and dignity of women was something Father emphasized very much, because he understood that it undermined something we don't appreciate as much today, that undermined a woman's dignity to allow herself to be co-opted, if you will, by living outside of wedlock. And so he really made pains to make sure that didn't happen. One French biography of him says his ability to be such a good priest in all these different ways came not from him but from his assiduous prayer. Like Fulton Sheen, he spent an hour a day before the Blessed Sacrament, at a minimum. And as the 1940s drew to a close, he started to realize something. And that was that he was good at pastoral work. He was really good at it. But he didn't believe that was his calling. He felt himself more drawn to a contemplative rather than active form of priestly life. So an opportunity came up to become a Trappist monk in England. The bishop asked for volunteers because the promise was that that he was going to be able to come back home one day and found a monastery there in Nigeria. And there wasn't any. And so this sounded like a really cool chance to take. And by 1963, so we're talking 10, 14, 15 years later, the plans to establish this long-dreamed monastery in Nigeria were complete, and Father Cyprian was to be the novice master. Great, right? Well, political tensions in that country, back then just as today, were always right at the boiling point. And it was such that the superiors made a last-minute, truly last-minute decision to found the convent next door, Cameroon, where there was no problem, there were no political problems, except for the fact that the main language, or one of the main languages, was French. So they needed someone who could speak both French and English, and Father Tonsi couldn't. And so that meant there was no role for him, and he became really, really angry. He was bewildered. I mean, you can imagine what it would be like if something like that happened to you or me. And it was the only time as a monk he was seen to lose his temper. After a short time, though, however, and this is what I think makes him a saint, he reminded himself that this was obviously God's will, and that he should, quote, accordingly have no other will but his, that is, God's. And to do otherwise, he realized, was spiritually dangerous. He died the following January 19, 1964, of an aneurysm. And so these are some of the reasons why we celebrate his memory today.
Yeah, somebody who really, puts in hard work in, a country that might not be all that Christian, but really puts in that time. Which brings me to the next guy that we have, this Father Saint Joseph Friedemann-Nemetz. I pronounce that one for me. Yep.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Yeah, you have to. I think January is the month of hard to pronounce priest names or saint names.
Right.
Yeah. So how do you pronounce this guy?
Hard to pronounce names. Period. Yeah. Saint Joseph Friedemann-Nemetz. I just really love this guy because missionaries. He was a missionary priest. And missionaries get this bad rap as being guys who are culturally, culturally superior and are arrogant about the cultures that they serve and, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. Well, not Father Friedemann-Nemetz. He was an ethnic German Italian. If you're familiar with Italy, you'll know that the northern part has, over the centuries, changed hands between Austria or Germany and Italy. And so the people in the northern part speak German. They're ethnically and culturally German, even though they belong to have an Italian citizenship. And so that was with Father Friedemann-Nemetz. And so for the first few years of his priesthood, he was this really popular priest and parochial school teacher. But he had this long and deep-seated desire, to bring pagan souls to Christ. And that led him to join the newly established missionary Society of the Divine Word in 1878. And for 2 years, they sent him to live in Hong Kong, learning the Chinese language and customs. And when it finally came time to light out to the hinterlands, they sent him to Shandong Province, where only, get this, 158 of its 12 million people were Christians.
Wow, that's not much.
Yeah, no, talk about having your work cut out for you. And he, because he was a poor missionary priest, he had to travel by foot from village to village, and occasionally bandits robbed and severely beat him. I mean, you're talking like almost put him in the hospital type beat him.
Mm-hmm. What time frame was this again?
Late 1800s.
Late 1800s, okay.
Yeah, so probably early 1880s or so is, when some of this stuff was happening. And what made matters, that wasn't the bad part. But the bad part was whenever he began to make progress with the local populace and start to make some converts, his bishop would always send him to another place because there was always a new need popping up. But all of this, all of these experiences, good and bad, caused him to fall madly in love with the Chinese people and everything about their culture. And because of this, he became as Chinese as possible. In fact, if you go online and look at some of the pictures of him, Father Friedemann-Nemetz looks Chinese. I mean, his eyes kind of take on almost an Asian character over the years. And he even said at one point, "I would like to be Chinese in heaven." He had a really, really intense prayer life. And he frequently exhorted people that they would never become saints without regular meditation and prayer. And isn't that you want to talk about something that would be good for a New Year's resolution. If you haven't found one yet, why not more regular meditation and prayer? You know, you spend it like Fulton Sheen, like Father Tonsi, he spent an hour each day in adoration. And, you know, he was one of these guys who exhausted himself on his vocation. He worked his fingers to the bone. And a typhus epidemic broke out amongst those he served. And he didn't spare anything to assist him. We hear about athletes, you know, going out and saying, we're not going to leave anything on the field. We're going to just give it all. Well, that's what he did. And as a result, though, he contracted typhus, and that in turn killed him in 1907.
Amazing figures. The missionaries do have that bad rap, as you mentioned, that they are oftentimes culturally sensitive, but sometimes they just absorb that culture and just bring so much joy to it, not only to the culture that they're serving, but I think to others, and it's probably a good reason for us to remember him.
Bishop Francis Ford, who was an American Mary Knoll missioner, was the same sort of, he never wanted to go back home. He always wanted to stay with his people in China because he had effectively become Chinese. You know, blonde hair and blue-eyed as he was, he was effectively a Chinese citizen. Not naturalized, but certainly, in his heart and soul, he was.
Well, one of the things that I observed in reading your books is that not all saints are clergy. Sometimes they can come in lay forms, and they might even be married. Right? So that's kind of odd. And that's the story with this guy, Blessed Laszlo Bathyany Strotman. Again, pronounce that name for me correct, and tell me this guy's story, because he wasn't a priest.
No, he wasn't. It's Bathyany Strotman. And so, you know, it's pretty close. It's a Hungarian name. And he was the sixth of a noble family's 10 boys. And he was a guy who, frankly, had a far from ideal childhood. I mean, first his father left the family to marry another woman, and dad became a Protestant in the process, left the faith. But then his mother died. Laszlo's mom died when he was just 12, and for a while he, in turn, was in danger of having his faith die. And indeed, during his university days, he drifted from the sacraments, stopped going to Mass, stopped going to confession, certainly, and that contributed, that lacking the life of grace in his soul, it contributed to his fathering a daughter out of wedlock. After graduation, though, he became a doctor, and he married a woman named Countess Maria Teresa Koreth, who helped him return to his faith. She was very, very pious, which shows, you know, there are a lot of good things to look for in a spouse, but the very first thing is to look for their faith. You know, like one of the people I write about in the first book, and we'll probably talk about him a bit later, his name is Blessed Franz Jägerstätter, and his wife, the first day that they met, it was at a village festival or something, she was introduced to him, and instead of saying, oh, hi, what do you do? Her first question out of her mouth was, do you go to Mass? And if he had said no, she was going to turn around and walk away. She just recently died at a little over age 100 years old. So, I mean, she was, but because of her example, he became a saint.
Okay, but wait a minute here. We're talking about Strotman. And
yeah,
you're telling me he fell away from
the... I was just making the point that it's important, like Blessed Laszlo did and Blessed Franz did, it's important for all of us to really make good choices. If we're single and we're called to the married life, to make... You know, make sure that person is a practicing, active Catholic to the greatest degree possible.
And I'm good with that analogy, but here's where I'm going with.
Yeah.
That Blessed Laszlo gets the blessed name, but shouldn't it have been his wife? What did Laszlo do? I mean, it seems like the wife brought him back to this faith after this time of aridness in his life, spiritual aridness. And so what's he doing to earn this title?
Well, the thing is, like I said, he was a doctor, right? And he was someone who could have been, I mean, if you've ever had the experience of coming into some money, or if you've ever had the experience, as I did, you know, I grew up in a upper middle class lifestyle as a child. And so when you are wealthy, the last thing you tend to think about are people. It takes a real grace, you know, because you're thinking about, you know, like John Rockefeller was asked, how much do you want to earn? always a dollar more. There's something that to that effect, right? So, you know, this man was never someone to do that. Even as a little boy, he wanted to be a doctor so that he could help the poor. And one of the things that he did, though, before getting into that was, you know, he and Maria Theresa had a very beautiful and happy marriage. And they were blessed with 13 children. I feel like a piker with six, you know, so I mean, wow, 13. But each day that he took the family to Mass, okay, this is what he did. I'm sure that it was a joint decision, but, you know, he, as the head of the household, made sure that they got to daily Mass, and after Mass, they would return home, where Laszlo would sit the children down for a catechism lesson. And after this, he would give them, each day, he would assign them an act of charity. You have to be nice to your sister. You have to go give bread to the poor. You have to go put some money in the poor box at the church, or what have you. And in the evening, after leading the family rosary, again, every single night doing this, he would lead them through an examination of conscience, and then he would discuss, how did you do on your act of charity? And this shows how seriously he took the church's teachings that parents are the first educators. He was just a doctor, had been just a doctor for just 2 years, and he founded a private, so personally financed, 25-bed hospital where he was a general practitioner, surgeon, and ophthalmologist. Now, 13 years later, in 1915, he inherited his uncle's title of prince and a castle. And instead of just having this big old castle to himself, he moves his family into one wing of it, and the other wing of this immense structure, he turns into an ophthalmology clinic. And people came all over the region for this, to see this man because of his skill. But the poor came especially because he never charged them anything. He always treated the poor for free. And, well, I'm sorry, let me take that back. He did charge them something. He charged them to say an Our Father for his soul. And upon discharging his patients after surgery, he gave them each a picture of the Christ and a spiritual book titled Open Your Eyes and See. You see, he believed healing was a gift from God, and that he was simply God's instrument in this respect. And indeed, before he each surgery, he would pray that God would bless his work and guide his hands. Unfortunately, in 1930, at the age of 60, he contracted bladder cancer and suffered with that for 14 months, intensely suffered with that, and then he went to his reward.
Yeah. Pretty impressive guy. I mean, this is, you know, these are people who, you know, loses his parents, but, you know, really sees the importance of parenting and sticks with it. And, you know, acts of charity are quite amazing. There are people who even go farther in their faith, and they pay the ultimate price of martyrdom for their faith, which is, for me, it's pretty impressive stuff when I read about a lot of these people. And I want to turn to some of those folks now. And some of them we celebrate here in January. One of them is a very interesting guy. Again, another layperson by the name of Nicolaus Gross.
Yeah.
And this guy is really interesting. In fact, when I was reading a bit about him, just to foreshadow what's going to come, he was involved in a plot to kill Hitler. One would have to say, well, how is this guy going to make the list? I thought kind of pacifists would get bumped up the list in that regard. But, I mean, he's at this point in time in world history, Nazi Germany, where he's really putting up a lot of resistance. It seems that Dietrich Bonhoeffer gets all the fame for this. Was this guy the Catholic Bonhoeffer?
You could say that, and certainly in terms of his writings about what a just and a Catholic Christian society would look like. You know, but he wasn't a theologian like Bonhoeffer, not by any stretch. You know, he was initially a very weak speaker who had to really work to become a decent orator. I think he goes to prove the truth of Jesus' words that we shouldn't worry about what we say, that if it's God's will that people be moved, you know, the Holy Spirit is going to do the speaking for us. But, you know, you talk about being a pacifist, and it's not really a prerequisite. You know, for instance, some try to claim Blessed Franz Jägerstätter, another Nazi victim, was a pacifist, but that wasn't in any way true. His writings show that had the Nazi cause been just or even morally negligible, you know, neither here nor there, he would have felt obligated to serve in the army. Instead, the he refused, and that's why Buster Franz was killed. Furthermore, nothing serves the cause of pacifism more than to sit and do nothing. Nothing, or less, I should say, serves the cause of pacifism less than to sit and do nothing in the face of tyranny. And Nicholas Gross, precisely because of his Catholic faith, was motivated to do something to change the tyranny that ruled his beloved Germany. But in his case, he didn't actually have anything to do with the planning and execution of the plot to kill Hitler. He simply knew about it. But the problem is that in the Third Reich, that was enough to cost him his life.
And so how does he rank to sainthood? Because, knowing about a plot to kill Hitler, I'm sure several other people did, but this guy somehow becomes a blessing.
Right. Well, the first thing is that he gave an heroic witness to the against the Nazis at a time. I mean, he was almost an out of the closet member of the anti-Nazi resistance. You couldn't be too much, obviously, because we all know where that would have gotten you. But he was from about 1927, when he was made editor of the Catholic Workers Movement newspaper, until the late 30s, when that newspaper was shut down, and then from the from that time until the time of his death, when he was a very high-ranking union official, Catholic trade union official, he was always talking about how what a Catholic society looked like, and whether he was making an explicit connection or an implicit connection, it was very evident that the regime was not anything close to being this. And shortly before his assassination, before the assassination attempt, I should say, a priest took him to task, saying, "Mr. Gross, should remember you have 7 children. I have no family for it. I'm responsible. It's a matter, though, of your life." And Gross gave me what to me is a really great statement as an answer. If we do not risk our life today, how do we then want one day to justify ourselves before God and our people?
Hmm.
Yeah. And so, it was also the way that he met his death. He wasn't crying. He wasn't screaming, begging for mercy. He simply said, bowed his head, took the priest's blessing, and died from hanging.
Yeah, and that's just the true nature and impact of a martyr, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the thing. If someone can be shown to have died for their faith, then they have no need to, if the Pope declares them a martyr, they have no need of going through the formal beatification process. Once the Pope declares you a martyr, and that's someone who dies because of hatred of the faith, and you can certainly make a great case that Blessed Nicholas fits that bill, then you're automatically declared a blessed.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting, another interesting pathway. And I should note, and this is something that I've learned through your writings and am fascinated about, it's not just individual martyrs, but sometimes groups, they come in packages, I guess, saints in packages and that. And one of those that comes up here in January are these folks known as the Blessed Martyrs of Podlachia.
That's right.
And who are these folks, and how did they come in the group package?
Well, they're also called the Pratulene Martyrs, and they were a group of 13 Greek or Byzantine Catholic believers killed by the Russian army on January 24th in 1884 in the village of Pratulene, which is on Poland's far eastern border with Belarus. And I don't know if you'll find a more chauvinistic, I'm sorry, this might offend some people, but I don't think you can find a more chauvinistic group of Christians in the world than the Russian Orthodox. And they have always resented and indeed rejected the existence of the so-called uniate churches, that is, those Eastern Rite churches that reattached themselves to the Roman Catholic Church or the Western Catholic Church in the 17th century. And in 1874, the Russian Tsar, whose empire included the Podlachia region, decreed that all Byzantine, which is another way of saying Eastern Rite Catholic churches, and possessions were to be confiscated and given over to the Orthodox Church. So on the day the confiscation was to take place, unarmed parishioners stood in front of their church in protest, and they wouldn't move, and so the Russian army fired upon them, killing 13 of their number. And a bunch of such massacres took place, but this was the one that was best known and best documented, and so the Blessed John, so that's why it was put forth, but Blessed John Paul II beatified them in 1996.
That brings up this other topic, and there are many other saints and blesseds that we could cover here in January, and I'm going to refer individual listeners to a number of your books. Visit our website and we'll link them up there, because the books are great reads. They're fun. They are filled with interesting stories, but they're also extremely motivational. They really inspire a lot of faith within the individuals who read it. So I'm going to push people in that direction, but I want to take a turn now to something that you wrote recently. And that was about these folks in Syria specifically, but Christian persecution in the Middle East and Egypt. And I can't remember the publication you wrote that in. We'll make sure that we link to it. But it's very interesting reading your insights on Christians being persecuted in places like Syria and Egypt today in relation to all the stuff that you were writing about in the saints throughout history, especially these folks who make it to the blessed ranking via martyrdom. What are your thoughts here? I mean, what are these people inspired by previous saints and blesseds? Are these people, you know, what makes these people tick?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, first of all, this is an I've always, in my studies, I have become a firm believer that the worst thing for Christianity is to become accepted. That is to say, accepted by the larger culture. When was American Catholicism strongest? Before 1960 and the election of President Kennedy, or after 1960 and his election, when Catholicism became a little bit more acceptable, especially in the wake of some of the false perceptions about Vatican II? Definitely since then. Has the church benefited and grown and flourished in the years since then? To an extent, yes, but also with the priest vocation crisis and the religious vocation crisis, certainly to an extent not. You know, 1 in 10 of every Americans are fallen away Catholics. So, you know, it really, really helps to be, in a sense, persecuted. And fun as that sounds, I know, and I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek, obviously.
Actually, there's good sociological evidence that shows that the strength and religiosity flourishes in times of persecution. The first 3 centuries of Christianity is living proof of that.
Yeah, and in this article, which was called Middle East Christians, Faith Under Fire, it was in National Catholic Register this came out this past Monday. One of the Egyptian priests I interviewed, because, boy, have the Muslim Brotherhood hit these people terribly, and the government up to this point in time, until just recently, has been right behind there with them. They have been really proud of the fact that they are producing martyrs and proud of the fact that they are not letting these people cow them. Now, it's true that there have been a flood. There's been an exodus out of Egypt, if you will, of Christians looking to escape persecution since the so-called Arab Spring, which has really become the Christian autumn. But that said, those who have stayed behind are staying behind because they realize they have a witness to give, not only to the people of their own nation and their Muslim fellow citizens, but also because to us who live in the West, to say, hey, look it, we're giving you martyrs. Hey, look it, our church was burnt down on August 15th. You know, when we started rebuilding it, August 16th. You know, there are pictures online you can find of Coptic churches where they're worshiping, they're having Sunday Mass inside of a burnt-out shell of a church. They put up a couple folding tables, they put out some folding chairs, bada-boom, bada-bing, they're back in business. They're not letting themselves be cowed by any of this. And, yeah, I do think that, you know, the Melkite Catholic Patriarch Gregorius III talks about the martyrs of Melulla in the town of Melulla, one of the oldest Christian cities in the world, It's a predominantly Christian village, and it's one of the few places in the world left where they speak Aramaic, which was the language of our Lord. And the Islamist rebels came in there, the Al-Qaeda-backed rebels came in there, and they took people at sword point with these big, heavy blades and said, look, we're going to cut off your head unless you convert. And five people in the village did. But then there were these three men, they were Catholic. They weren't Syrian Orthodox or anything like that. I think they were Melkite Catholics. And they said they refused. And they were threatened, and they refused. And they threatened again, and they refused. And finally, they had their heads chopped off. And, like I said, the Catholic Patriarch Gregorios III is calling them the Martyrs of Malula. Very inspiring stories. I mean, but just the fact that they hang around, that they don't move out, that they are turning the other cheek. The people in Egypt, when the Muslims came to raid their houses and their home and their orphanages and schools and churches, they had weapons. They could have fired upon these people who were attacking them. They refused to do so because they wanted to give this example of Christ.
Yeah, that is such a powerful story. And again, we'll link back to that article so people can read about this. And it's really indicative of, you know, saints who are martyrs, but saints in general, just going out of their way to do amazing things. And on those Sundays where there's a couple inches of snow and you feel very heroic for making it to Mass or Sunday services, you often have to stop and think, saying, you know what, there are some people who are really putting out for their faith and draw some inspiration from that.
Well, yeah, and, you know, it's what, not only that, but, I mean, what is a saint? St. Jose Maria Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei, and a few other saints as well, including Nicholas Gross, who we've just discussed, both of them said words to the effect of, a saint is someone who does ordinary things in extraordinary ways. So if you're going to love your spouse in an extraordinary way. If you're going to sacrifice for your children, don't just do it half-heartedly. Do it in an extraordinary way. When you're spouse asks you to take out the trash or do a favor for them, do it with love and joy in your heart, not, oh, I'm in my pajamas, come on. Not that I do that at all. No, never, never, ever. Kidding. But, it's doing these little things in our lives, doing them with love in our hearts, and doing them out of generosity in our hearts for God and for His greater glory, doing them in this extraordinary way that we will attain sainthood for ourselves.
Well, that is a wonderful way to finish up, because I just want to note that the works that you have done documenting the lives of these saints is certainly extraordinary in and of itself. And we're going to have you back, because there are so many other stories that you have to tell, and you do such a great job telling them. But for today, I want to thank you, Brian, for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you, Tony. All glory get to God. I mean, you know, I'm only a very poor instrument, but it's a lot of fun to be able to share these stories. So whenever you want, I'm more than happy to do so.
Amen.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.